I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. You know it, you hate it, and you've probably been infected with it before. It's the flu. With symptoms that include weakness, fever, and chills, it can keep you in bed for days. Good thing there's a vaccine for influenza, right? Well, there are those who swear by the flu shot and others convince it does more harm than good. Today, we're debunking common myths and answering your questions about the flu vaccine. Then, the art of changing another's mind. We'll learn why passion and emotion are often the driving forces behind successful arguments and why logic and reason rarely convince people. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's flu season. I just sat across from a man yesterday who appeared to be suffering from it, and I'm hoping beyond hope that I don't get it. And yes, I've had my flu shot. Turns out there are a lot of myths about the flu and the flu vaccine floating around out there. We're going to try to debunk them one misconception at a time with a pair of terrific experts who know their stuff when it comes to all things flu. With us, Charles Comia is the Jackson County Health Department's Communicable Disease Prevention Division Manager. Charles, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Marianne Jackson is here. She's a professor and the interim dean of the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine. Dean Jackson, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Before we get on into the myths here, this is the time of year to get a flu shot. Do I have that right, Dr. Jackson?
Absolutely. Nationally, we hope that everyone has their flu shot. I usually tell parents, if you and your family have not had your flu shots by the time you're putting on your Halloween costume, get to it.
Why this time of year? Why now?
Well, it takes 2 weeks to develop antibodies to protect you from the flu after your shot or the nasal mist. And for children under the age of 9 who require 2 shots if they've never had flu vaccine before, they require 6 weeks. We know that flu season usually has its onset around December, around Christmas.
Right.
There have been earlier seasons before, and so we want everyone to be prepared before we have that onset.
So kids under the age of 9 have to have 2 shots?
If they've not had a vaccine in the past, so we start vaccines for flu at age 6 months. So they get their first shot at the age of 6 months, and then they come back 28 days later, get the second shot. It takes 2 more weeks before they're protected. So for our youngest, it really requires that duration. But for our older kids, if they've had one vaccine in the past, then they'll get their annual vaccine.
So parents got to plan ahead here a little bit, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, Charles, it seems to me there are more places to get a shot than ever before. Are you seeing the same thing out there? Is that good news for those of you concerned about the flu?
Oh, absolutely. I really think that a lot of places, especially a lot of places of business, has been really great about, hey, we're going to be hosting a flu clinic at work. And so for a lot of people, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to avoid. Like your doctor's office will have them. I work at a health department and we give flu shots all the time. Or you could go to, you know, your place of business might be hosting a clinic right there. So
why is it so important that people get a flu shot? I mean, obvious reason is it'll help me from getting the flu. But there are other reasons out there, too, that you might encourage people to think about, right?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of reasons and a lot of benefits that come with getting the flu. Especially when it comes to reduction of severity of illness, if in case people do get the flu, in case of incidences of complications arising from the flu. Every year we see people who are hospitalized or even die from influenza. And so for a lot of people, you know, they don't want to talk it. You know, they think, oh, it's just the flu. It's not a big deal or something like that. But it's definitely something that we want to make sure that people understand.
So you're saying even if you've had a shot, you can catch the flu. And if you've had a shot, it might limit the severity of the kind of flu you experience.
A lot of it depends on the strain that is included in the flu shot. And so sometimes if the strain doesn't match perfectly or something like that, you kind of see some news stories about that. But even those who do get the flu shot, they tend to have less severe illnesses.
That's good news. Dr. Jackson?
What we know about the flu in children is that annually, on average, 100 children will die of influenza or influenza-related complications. Of those who die, 80 to 85% have not had a flu shot.
Wow.
And so we know we can reduce hospitalizations in children. We know we will reduce the risk of deaths in children.
Yeah.
And that is why it's so important.
And Charles, are there different types of vaccines out there? I mean, the kind of vaccination I might get here in Kansas City in Los Angeles, would it be different? Maybe?
You mean the type of strain? Because they do have different types of vaccines. Like they had the nasal spray a little while ago. They have a recombinant vaccine, which is egg-free. So for, you know, if individuals who have egg allergy to eggs.
Now, I mean the stuff that gets shot into me. Is it different in one part of the country than another? Or it's the same thing everywhere?
No, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
There are meetings in order to determine which strains are going to be included in the flu shot. And because the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere kind of alternate in terms of when the flu season is. And so at the beginning of one flu season, they kind of look and like, okay, what's circulating right now? Like what strains are prevalent?
Ah.
Which strains are causing the most havoc? And then they can kind of adjust the kind of, for lack of a better word, the recipe
right.
for the flu vaccine to be used in the opposite hemisphere.
That's interesting. Dean Jackson, I was wondering who on the planet Earth decides which what's going to be included in the flu shot each year? What components are going to be in there?
So the World Health Organization decides. They look at what's circulated.
The WHO, yeah.
That's right. They look at what strains circulated in the Southern Hemisphere to decide what we should use. This year, they took a month longer to make the decision. And the reason for that is one of the strains last year mutated through the season. And by the end of the season, the vaccine that was provided last year provided little protection against that strain later in the season. So they looked for the best strain this year. And every vaccine across the planet, essentially, will have coverage for four strains of flu, two for A and two for B strains.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those A strains, we call the H3N2 strain, that they took a little bit extra time to decide which one should be included in the vaccine. But that being said, all the vaccines are the same this year. They're all quadrivalent, which means four strains included. And you ask your doctor which of those shots is best for you.
Mm-hmm. Charles, what's the difference between the A and the B, Dr. Jackson? What am I looking at there?
So A strains, particularly the H3N2 strain, usually is most severe. And so that strain last year led to more hospitalizations and routinely leads to more deaths in individuals who do get the flu. And one thing that I think is a myth is that there's going to be one strain that circulates. It's actually multiple strains circulate every year. So last year, one strain started and it was relatively mild disease and everybody felt like, oh, this is going to be
right.
a moderate season. You can't tell. And what happened was H3N2 came on the heels of that and created a very severe year. So last year was the longest duration of flu we had seen in the last couple of decades, lasting 20 weeks, where on average, the flu season lasts about 3 months or 12 weeks.
Wow. Charles, I've always wondered this. Why do we worry about flu in the winter but not in the summer?
Honestly, a lot of that comes with the circulation of the flu virus and how the flu seasons, as I said, were going to alternate between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere. So while we experience the flu season in general between October and May, the Southern Hemisphere sees influenza activity between April and September.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that's just kind of circulating, going back and forth, and then that's when we meet up to determine which strains are going to be included in our flu vaccine.
I mean, do the germs tend to survive longer in cold weather months? Do we have any feel for that, Dr. Jackson?
So this has been bandying about through the years because there are certain viruses that only come in the winter. RSV, which is respiratory syncytial virus, causes wheezing illness in babies. Influenza only comes in the winter. People don't know why especially, but it may well have to do with temperature or winds. But we don't see flu in the United States in the summer months unless somebody comes from the Southern Hemisphere where they're experiencing their winter and comes to the
U.S. Interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking this morning about the flu and some common myths that seem to circulate around the flu every year. I'm visiting with Charles Comia. He's with the Jackson County Health Department. Dr. Mary Ann Jackson is a professor of the interim dean at the UMKC School of Medicine. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Charles, how young can a child be before he or she gets the first flu shot here?
As you know, we were saying a little bit earlier, that the flu shot is recommended for anyone 6 months of age or older. But with all medical decisions, I'd say definitely consult your healthcare provider and make sure that they understand your situation and they can make the best recommendation for you.
And how old can you be, Dr. Jackson?
We recommend from 6 months to forever.
Forever?
For however old you are. And keep in mind that individuals who are 65 and older, most likely to die. Actually, if you look at it, it's probably age 50 and older, most likely to die from flu, or for the youngest baby. So for those under the age of four. And keep in mind that anyone can get a flu shot, whether or not your immune system is affected or not. You just may not respond as well to it. So that's why I say if there's somebody in your family who has heart disease, who has cancer, whose immune system doesn't work, that's the reason for you to get protected, even if you feel like you're very healthy and you never get the flu.
Do I need a flu vaccine every year?
Yes, absolutely.
I can't take a year off because I've had a bunch in a row.
No, there isn't one of those, like, buy four of get five through, get the fifth free kind of things.
There should be, though, right? Yeah. Okay. Is it ever too late to get one?
Honestly, no. That's one big misconception that a lot of people have. It's like, because we put out messaging just, you know, like she was talking about, the try to get your vaccine before the end of October. Mm-hmm. And so November 1st hits and some people are like, oh, I missed the window.
Right.
You know, they're not going to have it. And you know, places are going to have it available. I know that the health departments I work at and work with, we keep it in stock and make sure that it's never too late.
Yeah, and this idea too that if you get one late, that it's going to last longer. Some people think I don't have to get it in October because I don't want to catch it in April or May.
So actually, we're doing some more research on that. The general assumption is that after you get your flu shot, you're going to have antibody that lasts for between 4 and 7 months. Mm-hmm. In adults, though, the antibody may wane, and it may wane over time. So we're actually doing some specific studies to look at how long will your flu shot last.
And whether I should get another one in February, for instance.
So we don't have a recommendation that says you'd have to get a second one, but we're starting to look at that in more detail because we realize how important it is to protect individuals from the flu.
Okay. Let's turn to some of these myths that we've been talking about here. Here's one that you hear a lot, Charles. Can you catch the flu by getting a flu shot?
That is a myth that I've heard very often.
A lot, yes.
Right. More than I'd care to admit. No, you cannot get the flu from the flu shot.
Okay. And we're pretty sure about that?
Very.
Some people say, though, they don't feel so hot after they've gotten a flu shot. Why is that?
Well, after you get a flu shot, your immune system is activated, and there are some short-term effects that you might feel. When I got mine, you might feel a little bit feverish or something like that, and at the injection site, it might be a little bit red. Your arm might be a little bit sore, and those things are very normal.
Is it in any way better to actually catch the flu, Dr. Jackson, compared to getting the flu vaccine? Is there any benefit to getting sick from it?
Absolutely not. Influenza is one of the worst infections. It has an acute onset with high fever, severe myalgia, respiratory symptoms. It generally last no matter what for 3 to 7 days, and complications often follow, particularly in those at risk for severe complications. It is a severe infection, and generally getting the flu shot, it is mild local reactions, a sore arm, a little bit of muscle pain for just a very short period of time.
My arm's always sore for a day or two.
Exactly, yeah. For a day or two. But that's about what you get compared to what true influenza is.
Yeah, Charles?
I would also add that with influenza, you can spread the disease before you start to show symptoms. And so a lot of times you can actually infect somebody before you even start to feel sick with influenza.
Wow.
Therefore, it's a system where you could get sick, not know it, spread it to somebody else. And especially as she was saying, you know, protecting the people around you, it's very, right. very important.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. We have a question on Twitter from Charlotte who wonders, do people in warmer parts of the country not wind up getting the flu in the winter?
Absolutely not. If you look across the country, you will see influenza spreads in all parts of the country.
No kidding.
And actually, at the Centers
for Disease
Control.
I would think in Florida you wouldn't catch it as much.
No, it circulates there just as well as it circulates in Kansas City, Missouri. And there is no part of the country that is immune.
Huh. What about this idea that's also out there, Charles, that getting two flu shots is a way to add to your immunity shield, if you will? Is that a good idea?
That's not exactly something that there's a recommendation for in terms of determining the added benefit of receiving do you mean like a second shot in succession?
Yeah, like a second shot 2 weeks later or something like that.
I don't know of any recommendation in terms of that, in terms of any kind of added benefit that you'd have.
Yeah. Doctor?
There is a shot, though, for age 65 and older that has 4 times the antigen in it than a standard dose vaccine.
Really?
So rather than getting a second shot, for 65 and older, you can get what we call a high antigen vaccine that is more protective for that population that is at greatest risk for death. And if we looked at across the country at who gets vaccinated, our adults who are 65 and older, they go for it. Still, it's only 70% of that population that's immunized. In the pediatric population, about 60% of kids get immunized. In that in-between population from 18 to essentially 50, that is the under-immunized population that then transmits flu to you.
Do you have to ask your pharmacist or your doctor if you're over 65, I want the heavy dose thing?
You do. And in fact, one of the more common questions that I get is, what if I can't find it? What if my doctor has stocked the regular antigen vaccine? So the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics has basically said you should not miss an opportunity to get immunized. If that is what available, then get it. But you can look for that. So many adults are getting immunized at retail pharmacies.
Yeah.
And you can ask for that vaccine specifically.
So you ought to be proactive and look out for your best
Absolutely.
Interests here. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Charles. Yeah.
Oh, no. And I was going to say that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention do a study in terms of vaccination coverage among adults. And while she was saying that the percentages among the really young and the elderly are much higher, the average in the 2017-2018 season was about 37% of adults receiving the flu vaccine.
37%. So good. So 6 out of 10 adults don't get it.
My brain isn't ready for that kind of math right now. But
yeah.
And it's usually the young adult who is healthy who says, I don't get the flu. I don't need to be vaccinated.
Right.
And yet we're trying.
My coworker up on the hill says, I don't ever get a flu shot.
Exactly. And that's a common mentality that we see. If you've ever had influenza, you never want to get it again. I say, though, if you want to protect those around you, if you want to cocoon those who are at risk, be part of that herd immunity.
What would happen if every adult in the country had a flu shot? What would be the impact on the flu?
Well, once you have herd immunity against diseases that we can protect against, it means the more who are protected, the less likely it is that the virus will pass person to person. And so we would see a reduction in influenza morbidity and mortality.
Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about the flu and myths surrounding the flu. Let's go to Byron from Liberty. Byron, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, doctor. My question is, if you've got allergies or cough or sneeze or runny nose, can you still get a flu shot?
That is a great question. And the answer to that is yes. Unless you have moderate illness, and your doctor will be the best to tell you whether or not you have an illness that creates a reason to defer vaccine till later. But sniffles, a cough, if you don't have fever, if you're feeling well, if you're doing your normal activities, then you can be vaccinated.
And should you tell your pharmacist or your doctor that, hey, you have the flu or the sniffles?
So sniffles and the flu are completely different. Okay. But if you say, yes, I have a runny nose and a cough right now, they'll ask you, are you still going to work? Do you have a fever? How do you feel right now? Those individuals can and should be immunized.
Charles, what about pregnant women? Should they get a flu shot?
Oh, absolutely. It's recommended that a pregnant woman receive a flu shot every year, just like, you know, everybody else. But the influenza is more likely to cause severe illness in pregnant women than in women of reproductive age who are not pregnant.
Oh, is that right?
That is right. So and flu shots given during pregnancy can help protect both the mother and the baby from flu.
Mm-hmm. What about another reason that some people give to avoid vaccination is they're wary of the ingredients that are found in the vaccine, like formaldehyde or mercury, Dr. Jackson. What do you say to that?
So vaccine ingredients are harmful is a myth that we need to debunk. Aluminum is one of the most common adjuvants in vaccines, and it is in the air, in food, in drink. In fact, infants get more aluminum in breast milk or in formula than in vaccines. In terms of formaldehyde, that's used to detoxify certain toxins and to inactivate viruses in vaccines. Formaldehyde is found in many products, including paper towels, mascara, carpeting. Levels are detectable in human blood at higher rates than are found in vaccines. So I think we need to be thoughtful about understanding. You do need to share with your doctor if you have an allergy, for instance, to certain ingredients like gelatin, mm-hmm, or to certain antibiotics. So do share that with your physician. But for the common things that are contained in vaccines, I want to reassure the public.
So you're not suggesting we should have any concerns about how vaccines are manufactured, Dr. Jackson?
So vaccines are among the greatest health achievements in our last century. They're safe, effective, and they've been subjected to more study than any other medication that is on the market. So I think the public needs to understand that and need to understand that there is a strong vaccine safety initiative within this country.
We had a caller from Patrick wants to ask this, Charles. His wife is 66, got ill from the extra size dosage that's recommended for elderly folks. She says that gave her the flu. What would you say to Patrick?
I think the doctor might be able to answer this a little bit better, but that's not something that can give you the flu, mm-hmm, just like based on like how the vaccine works and how it works in your body.
I will say that the higher dose antigen can give you a more sore arm, and it will maybe give you a few more muscle aches.
Right.
It is not the flu. What happens typically, though, is an individual will get a virus that's circulating in the community. Like right now, there are three viruses that are circulating in our community that are not the flu. They are human metapneumovirus, and adenovirus, and parainfluenza virus. When you get those viruses, they will make you feel like you have some type of respiratory infection. Mm-hmm. Indeed, it is just not the flu. And so you get the shot, the next day you develop symptoms from one of these other infections, and you assume it must have been...
How can you tell one from a regular cold from the flu? What's the distinction?
So there's maybe three things that individuals can know. Number one, the regular cold will not give you high fever. The flu will give you high fever, and mm-hmm, I'm talking 103 to 104. The regular cold will not give you severe muscle aches. Flu will give you the worst muscle aches ever. In fact, it will shut you down. You will go home and go to bed because, mm-hmm, you're so achy. The regular flu is the regular cold is not associated with serious complications. The flu is. And so if you develop pneumonia, that is likely a flu-related complication.
Well, lots of things to think about here. I want to thank our guest. That was the voice of Dr. Mary Ann Jackson. She's a professor and interim dean of the UMKC School of Medicine. Charles Comia is the Jackson County Health Department's Communicable Disease Prevention Division Manager. Thank you both for some good information. Sure appreciate it. Yeah.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the importance or maybe the overemphasis on being reasonable and what does that really get you? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. My weekly newsletter is called Kraske Off Mic, and you can have it delivered right to your mailbox each Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up for a commentary from me and highlights from the up-to-date crew. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Thursday on the show, test scores are in for Kansas City Public Schools, and they're confusing. Join us as we look at the new scoring system and learn what it means for accreditation. That's on tomorrow's Up to Date here on KCUR. Well, Eleanor Gordon Smith was doing a story for This American Life based on a simple idea. She would walk around a nightlife spot in Sydney, Australia, and wait for the catcalls to start. Then she would confront the catcallers and try to dissuade them from doing this sort of thing ever again. It sounded like this.
Did you just make a gesture like breasts?
I like saying hello to women. I like being friendly to women.
Okay, so here's my
thing. They love it.
So you think that they like it?
They have to.
Why?
It's a nice thing when a man says hello.
So a guy just looks for a reaction, a smile. You're a dickhead. Hi.
A smile and you're a dickhead are both equally good?
Both equally as good.
So it's just attention?
No, it gives you a platform for you to start.
How many successful relationships do you think have started from someone saying you're a dickhead?
Zero.
Well, Eleanor failed to dissuade anybody to do anything in her bid here to convince people to walk away from that kind of behavior. A champion debater in high school, her well-framed, highly logical arguments just fell flat. Then it dawned on her, changing people's minds with dispassionate logic, no matter how spot on, often doesn't work. What does sway people are emotions, ego, and self-interest. That's what changes minds, and Eleanor Gordon Smith lays it all out in a new book, Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. Eleanor, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What makes you think, and what made you think that you could change the minds of these men who had just wolf-whistled at you?
Some combination of optimism and self-belief, I think. So I had a pretty strong background in high school debate and, you know, the sort of more formal elements of like argument construction and critical thinking. I did a lot of philosophy as I was coming through university, spent a lot of time in radio, like interviewing people in ways that were sort of pretty standard argument construction formats. And I felt like if I had the patience and the energy to go out and try to find out, like, why do these men do this? Why do they think that this is a fun thing to do? That my genuine interest in finding out what this was for them, plus a bit of time, plus a bit of my understanding of how argument construction works, you know, I genuinely might be able to have a moment with them where they were candid with me about what it meant to them, but more importantly, where I was able to kind of get through to them. That was the hope, anyway.
And you were going to solve this problem for women around the globe once and forever, right?
Well, no, I don't think the brief was that extreme. No, really, really, the only thing that I wanted as I was sort of starting out was to have a genuine moment of honesty from them about what this meant to them, about like why they did it. And honestly, if I could have got one person to change their mind, that would have been enough.
You know, I was surprised that these guys even agreed to talk to you after doing something like this.
Yeah, it was surprising for me as well. This is something that I talk about in the book when I'm kind of dissecting this this experience myself. I totally had this surprise. You know, I was walking around, like I have, you know, glasses and a kind of nerdy reportery vibe. I was carrying a big like recorder and a big proper microphone, and it's very like mean looking. Like it's got a big flashing red light. It doesn't look like the kind of thing that will be forgiving to you if you speak into it while you're drunk, which a lot of these guys were. But no, I was really surprised. A lot of them I think they were just excited that a girl had come over to talk to them, or they were excited to have the chance to be on air somewhere. But they were really very forthcoming with me. It was kind of a nice surprise.
So what kinds of things did they say to you beyond what we just heard about why they had done what they had done?
I was really surprised by the motivation that they all eventually came up with. They all said something, you know, like the pastiche that you just heard, this kind of strange motivation list that they would come up with, like, oh, I'm flirting, or it's fun for her, or I'm just doing something funny. But once you dug around in their motivations a little bit, the thing that I got from every single one of them was that they really felt like women enjoyed this. You know, this was something that they were doing so that the woman that they were speaking to would have as much fun as they had yelling out to her.
And that was
bizarre to me.
What did you say to them in your bid to convince them they were being so disrespectful?
Right. So once I had this acknowledgement from them that they felt like it was important that women were enjoying themselves, I really felt like it was a very short step from that to the conclusion that they ought not to do it, right? Because here's how the argument goes. I do it in part because women like it, and then someone comes along and tells me women don't like it and gives me evidence to that effect. Well, then the motivating reason that I had for doing this dissolves, and I have no further reason to engage in this. In fact, I have quite strong reason not to engage in this. So I really thought that it was a kind of a short step. So the thing I tried to say was just, you know, your confidence that women are enjoying this, like, what is that based on? Where do you get this sense that this is really fun for women? And they would say, well, everyone I ever do this to laughs and smiles and kind of has a good time with me. And I would say, well, look, the fact that women are laughing and smiling isn't of itself particularly good evidence. Like, very often, people and women in particular laugh and smile because they're uncomfortable. It's precisely because they're not enjoying themselves that they are doing this kind of display of like, haha, yeah, that's totally funny. Like, please leave now. And that means that your evidence for the fact that women are enjoying this is deeply unreliable evidence and you shouldn't count on it. So I would say this over and over again. And to me, that sounds like a really
so logical
argument.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
right
yeah.
And they would just say to me, you can't speak for all women, you know. Here was I, someone who is a woman, and they would tell me with apparently greater authority that they had better insight into how women were feeling.
So is that what got you thinking then about this whole notion, that's the premise of your book, that it's not logic that causes people to change their minds, it's something else?
I mean, it's not. I don't know that it's necessarily the case that I think that it's not logic. I think one of the things that writing the book has really done for me is to kind of restore a lot of the optimism and the hope in our ability to change people's minds that I lost by doing this catcalling experiment. But I think that there is something missing. I think there's something that we can generally forget when we try to set out to change people's minds in the way that I did in this experiment, but also in the way that, you know, we do in so many political environments, that we do when we put two members of opposing sides up on a panel and we put them on TV and we act like this is going to be some kind of debate that will change people's minds. The thing that we forget in all of that, and the thing that I forgot as I was having these conversations with these men, is that it's not just logic and argument, and there are really important elements of rational persuasion that are much more human and intimate and particular and idiosyncratic than just a list of reasons and evidence.
And some of that, perhaps, some would argue, might begin to explain why we have the president in this country that we have today.
It's a tricky balance to cut, because on the one hand, one of the things that I want to say in the book is that many of the things that we excise from the traditional realm of rational debate, things like emotion and our sense of self and who we trust, you know, I want to make the case in the book, and I do, that many of these things are, in fact, perfectly rational ways of formulating our beliefs. So it's not, in fact, totally irrational to try to reason with someone based on their emotions, that emotions, just as well as beliefs, can be perfectly rational responses to sets of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, at the same time as many of these things, I think, belong in a rational account of how we change people's minds, they're also, as you say, you know, tools, and like any tool, they can be used for a variety of purposes.
Our guest is Eleanor Gordon Smith. Her new book, Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. I was going to say, you've already referred to this, but what does all this mean for our political system and this notion of so often, you know, pitting two people with different views up on a TV screen or in an auditorium, two presidential candidates, two candidates for governor? Are we doing it wrong?
I think that we are. And the reason that I think we are is kind of, well, I mean, it requires a bit of It requires a bit of examination of like why I particularly came to this view. And so the reason that I wound up thinking that we're doing a lot of our public persuasion wrong is that after I finished speaking to these catcallers and after I finished kind of trying to do my own little persuasive project, I went out for the book and I spoke to a lot of people who have changed their minds. So I went and spent, you know, just over 2 years interviewing a whole bunch of people who have changed their minds in really high stakes, very surprising ways.
Yes.
So people who let go of beliefs that were really foundational to themselves and their sense of, you know, who they were and how they saw themselves in the world. And the reason I wanted to go and talk to people who had changed their minds was I wanted to see what happens when it goes right. You know, what are the ingredients that are present in a mind change that actually manages to succeed that might be missing from the kind of more familiar types of mind changes that we see around us where, you know, people get close to a new belief but they don't actually go through with it, or they get real close to a conclusion but they don't end up accepting it.
You know,
and speaking
–
sorry.
Yeah, no, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that speaking to those people like really illuminated for me what I think you're getting at in your question, and like what are we doing wrong mm-hmm. with our bigger political sphere? And the reason the thing that I think is missing – is that in every one of these stories of people that I spoke to who changed their minds in these very surprising high-stakes ways, it was such a personal, idiosyncratic process, and it was so much to do with the genealogy of why they thought what they thought. So in order to understand why any of the people in the book changed their mind, you have to really understand why they believed what they believed to start with. Mm-hmm. And very often, the answer to that is not, well, there's a list of facts and I just responded to those facts. You know, the explanation is much more rooted in their history as an individual. It's much more to do with, you know, what was this belief doing for them? What purpose was it serving? Which part of their identity was it propping up? Like,
right.
Where did they inherit it from? And that kind of attention to the person, I think, is often really missing when we try to change people's minds in public.
You know, it also struck me in reading through some of the examples in the book that there's an element of chance involved here when it comes to getting people to change their minds. And one, maybe the best example of that is the story of Dylan.
Mm.
And let me just set this up a little bit here. You know, he had belonged to this very strict religious sect. And years after his wife, Missy, had suggested that he rethink his involvement, she was always coming at him with one factoid after another, if you will, saying, hey, have you thought about this? Hey, have you thought about that? And years passed, and Dylan wasn't changing his mind. Her arguments fell flat. Then something happened as a result of a telephone call that Dylan received. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite moments in the book as well. Precisely. I mean, your diagnosis is exactly right. You know, it's he got so lucky. So he and Missy met when they were both working in a restaurant. And as someone trying to interview them, it's really like frustrating because they're so in love and so like fused.
They answered each other's thoughts. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, they're just like every sentence is a collaborative exercise for them, and they have this amazing connection despite the fact that, you know, as you say, she wasn't a believer of the religious group that he was a member of. But nonetheless, you know, he had this tremendous loyalty towards and trust in his wife. And then one day he gets a phone call from one of his religious leaders who says to him, you have to choose. We've decided that your wife is threatening to this group, that she doesn't have our best interests at heart, and you need to choose between your wife and salvation because you can only
have one.
But tell
us about the guy who made the call. That adds a whole lot to this story.
Yeah, it really does. So the guy who made the call was in fact someone who in many ways owed Missy his life.
Yes.
So he was someone who so Missy works in healthcare, and she had seen him giving, you know, a speech from a pulpit, as it were, and he was getting like particularly puce-faced and looking quite unwell. And she recognized in him certain signs of impending cardiovascular disaster. You know, it looked like he was about to have a heart attack. And she went and kind of spoke a bit beyond her station, but went to go and see his spouse and say, you know, I think he's in trouble. I think he looks like he's really about to have a terrible health event. And so on Missy's advice, they went and spoke to a doctor. And it turned out that he was, in fact, you know, like, not moments, but sort of very, very close to having a heart attack. And he wound up changing his medication and having a couple of procedures.
Wow.
And if it hadn't been for Missy's intervention, there is a very good chance that he would have died.
So Missy saves this guy's life.
Right.
And then the same guy calls her husband and says, hey, bucko, you got to think about choosing between this religious sect or your wife, because it's not working with your wife.
Because she's threatening somehow. Yeah. And this, to Dylan, was horrifying. You know, that someone who could have such firsthand evidence of the way that Missy was kind, was thoughtful, was loyal, looked out for people, that someone with all that evidence, someone, you know, who literally owed their life to Missy, could nonetheless say, she's got to go. That did this amazing thing for Dylan, which was it made him realize that his religious elders could be wrong. You know, if they could be wrong about their adjudications of his wife, why not be wrong about the nature of the universe or the nature of God or what happens after we die?
And so it took this emotional response, this angry response at the telephone call to get him to look at the religious group he belonged to in a completely different light, despite years of his wife saying, hey, husband, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that?
Exactly. And it leads me, you know, in this chapter, one of the kind of analyses that I give is very often it's not what we believe, it's who we believe.
Yes.
So the thing that did the work for Dylan in changing his mind actually had nothing to do with evidence or standard reasons. It had to do with the fact that he trusted his wife more than he trusted these people. And that trust and leveraging that trust was the thing that ultimately brought him closer to the truth.
So, again, rational arguments had absolutely no impact on Dylan. It took a moment completely out of the blue to turn things around for him.
Exactly. And lucky, as you say.
I also was struck by that. I was amazed that Dylan and Missy sort of managed to carve out what appeared to be a successful marriage despite his involvement with this group.
I know. Isn't this amazing? I really think that this story is a kind of a pretty profound love story. And in fact, I think one of the beautiful things about it is I think Missy, in many ways, engaged in an act of faith which is even stronger than any of the acts of faith that he engaged in as a believer. You know, she looked at him, someone who was so deeply ensnared in this way of thinking, and she thought, like, I can see through this to the man that you will be once you're out of this environment, and that man is someone that I love and I want to be with. So she married him. She had kids with him. You know, she moved into this religious environment with him, all just based on the hope that she would one day be able to get him out and that the man he would be then would be the man for her.
But again, it took this chance moment, if you will, this phone call from this elder in the group to sort of begin to change the dynamics here. Without that phone call, maybe Dylan still belongs to the group.
Maybe. You know, it's really hard to say what would have happened in like the nearby alternative universes.
Of course.
I think that, you know, one of the things that I did a lot in the course of writing this book is to read a lot of other accounts of the ways that these sudden moments of change happen. And the writer William James is someone who comes to mind for me a lot. And he has this wonderful image that, you know, many times the things that seem to us to be moments of sudden change are actually the product of like very long incubation that has been bubbling away under the surface.
Right.
So I wonder whether part of why that phone call was so significant for Dylan was that Missy had been chipping away at something underneath the surface.
She laid the groundwork for him, right.
Yeah. Maybe he wasn't aware of it. Maybe she wasn't aware of it. But maybe if it hadn't been that phone call, it would have been something else. But, you know, we will never know.
So the walkaway lesson from this, then, it's still a little fuzzy. Is he here? Eleanor, how would you frame that?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the walkaway lesson, I think, for me is the thing about trust, is that very often, you know, so let's say that you and I are going out into the world and we've got relatives or friends or people who are trapped in these kinds of in-groups, not unlike Dylan's, where the belief set is really rigid and you're punished for thinking otherwise. It's really hard to know how to change someone's mind in that situation. But I think Dylan's story is a really beautiful lesson, namely, you don't need to busy yourself with giving this person arguments and counter evidence, because while that might work, it will take a long time to work. One other thing we can do, and this is something that I try to do in a lot of the stories in the book, is to try to bring like one strategy to bear. The other thing we can do, I think, is look at like why do they trust their authority figures so much? Mm-hmm. And what else could we do to upset their allocations of trust? Because for Dylan, that was it. You know, it was the moment of realizing if my elders can get my wife wrong, then they can get everything else wrong as well. And there, I think, is a sort of useful blueprint in that for the rest of us. Namely, when the people I love or the people that I care about are trusting some authority figure too much, mm-hmm. what can I do to upset that level of trust? And it might not be giving evidence, you know, it might be something deeply personal in the way that it was for Dylan. But for me, that's the lesson, you know, trying to find ways to reallocate the way that they distribute their trust.
So as families get ready to sit around the Thanksgiving table in this country this year, you know, so many Democrats absolutely apoplectic at their Republican friends and even family members for supporting this president. And they keep coming at these folks with these arguments rooted in logic, and they're wondering why they don't work. Hopefully, perhaps you're giving them a set of reasons for why they should rethink their approaches.
I mean, I hope so. I really hope so. This has been one of the really nice things about working on this project, is that people read the book and get in touch with me and tell me how the stories in the book manage to give them a sort of map for their own, you know, attempts to change other people's minds. And I think that, you know, there's a number of really weird stories in the book, stories about people who had one who left a cult, one who discovered that her spouse was keeping a terrible secret,
yes,
man who discovered that, you know, his own family isn't his. These are moments of really big upheaval. But I think the thing that they all have in common, and they can teach us as we go forward into these terribly frustrating dinner tables, is that mind changes are extraordinarily complex, they're extraordinarily intimate and individual, but that also they require a huge amount of patience. You know, like the yes. day you plant the seed is not the day you eat the fruit.
Exactly. Patience is key. And again, like Dylan and Missy, laying the groundwork might be not a waste of time whatsoever, because perhaps it could pay off down the road.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, our guest again has been such an interesting conversation here. Eleanor Gordon Smith, her new book, Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. That your title? It's a good title.
Thank you very much. Stop Making Sense was taken, so we had to go with this.
You had to go with that. Good luck with the book, Eleanor. So good
Thank
to spend
much.
Some time
what a pleasure
with you.
To talk to you.
You bet. Yesterday on the show, a Kansas City group is seeking protections for renters. You can hear about the Tenant Bill of Rights they'll be presenting to the City Council. You'll find it at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, women gained the vote in 1920, but the fight for equality didn't end there. We'll examine what rights were fought for decades after the 19th Amendment passed. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.